Gonzalez, I want to thank you for being with us, founder of La Frontera. I'm Amy Goodman.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and KBOO Community Radio is very proud to be the first FM station in the state of Oregon to program jazz. Let's celebrate KBOO's diverse jazz programming and the jocks who volunteer their talent to share their love of jazz music. Jazz Appreciation Month, or JAM as it's affectionately known, represents a sweet spot in the lives of KBOO's music lovers. So join us on Wednesdays, noon to 4, and Saturdays, 2 to 5, throughout the month of April, as we toast America's greatest art form here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an April snow in Portland brings school closures, power outages, and downed trees. A metro attorney says a proposed temporary shelter ballot does not meet constitutional standards. And in international news, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warns of a new Russian offensive in the nation's east. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 11th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. People in the Portland area woke Monday morning to an inch or more of snow on the ground. The National Weather Service issued weather warnings and watches throughout the region Monday, from winter storm warnings to coastal wind advisories. Portland International Airport reported 1 inch of snow, the most ever recorded in the month of April for the region. Airport snow records date back to October 1940. Meteorologists say this is the first time in the 82 years of record keeping that measurable snow has fallen at PDX this late in the year. Thousands of Portland General Electric and Pacific Power customers were without electricity in Portland and surrounding areas. PGE reported nearly 65,000 of its customers had lost power, while Pacific Power reported nearly 17,000 customers without electricity, with most of those in the Portland metro area. School districts across the metro area, including large districts like Portland, Beaverton, Tigard-Tualatin, and Vancouver, announced closures and delays due to the snow. The state's largest school district, Portland Public Schools, was closed for the day. The snow made for a slippery Monday morning commute, with multiple road closures throughout the area. There were also reports of multiple downed trees. Weather forecasts show scattered precipitation for Tuesday and Wednesday, which could bring more early morning flurries later this week. People for Portland's temporary shelter ballot measure has been rejected by Metro Regional Government's legal team. The local measure would have repurposed tax dollars set aside for supporting housing programs in Portland and instead use the funds for short-term shelters. The measure was introduced on March 25th by lobbyist group People for Portland. It addressed a previously approved 2020 ballot measure that issues a 1% tax on high-income households in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington County to fund supportive housing services. These services include programs that help unhoused people move into permanent housing, as well as maintaining that housing with the help of on-site social services, such as detox programs, medical care, and child care. Since the new funding was first distributed to counties in the summer of 2021, the money has gone toward opening new low-income housing programs, covering rent vouchers, and supporting programs that help people with mental illness retain housing. The Metro Ballot Initiative proposed redirecting 75% of all supportive housing services funds towards temporary shelters. It also suggested withholding those funds from municipalities that did not sweep camps of unhoused people and would have allowed members of the public to sue elected officials for not upholding the ballot measure's promises. In a letter sent Friday, Metro attorney Carrie McLaren wrote that the proposed initiative does not pass legal muster to move forward. Specifically, the measure proposed to tinker with administrative elements of policy, which ballot initiatives are not allowed to impact under the Oregon Constitution. McLaren added that the proposed initiative lacks an ordaining clause, which is also required under Metro Code. People for Portland and the individuals who signed on as petitioners for their initiative are allowed to challenge McLaren's decision. In a statement posted to social media, People for Portland accused the ruling of being politically driven. Here Together, the nonprofit coalition behind Metro's original supportive housing services measure, applauded McLaren's ruling on Friday. The group said, in reference to the People for Portland ballot measure, quote, "The Metro attorney's decision today is evidence that the measure was always more about politics than good policy. A poorly crafted ballot measure aimed at changing direction a year from now was never going to provide immediate relief for our unhoused neighbors." Portland General Electric took legal action on Friday against the state of Oregon to condemn a piece of property alongside Willamette Falls. The location is critical to fishing access for many Northwest tribes. The move, together with a notice of condemnation, could allow the utility to control access to roughly 5 acres of land at the base of Willamette Falls. PGE has been in an ongoing dispute over who has authority over the property. The Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde have permission from the state to operate a fishing platform at the base of the falls. Officials with PGE said the utility has spent 3 years trying to resolve the property dispute with the Oregon Department of State Lands. That's the department that granted the permit to the Confederated Tribes on land that the utility argues is part of its licensed hydroelectric project at the falls. Other tribes have said the state's decision to grant permission to the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde interferes with their treaty fishing rights at the falls. Dolores Pigsley, who chairs the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians Tribal Council, said in a statement that the state of Oregon and the Grand Ronde tribes bypassed the process 5 tribes had agreed to in 2005, which allowed all of the tribes to have cultural access to the falls. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned of an increasing Russian offensive in the nation's east. Satellite images appeared to show an 8-mile-long convoy of Russian military vehicles moving south towards the Donbas region that seems most likely to be the focus of a major new offensive. The move comes as Russia has appointed a general with a record of brutality in Syria to take over operations in Ukraine. General Alexander Dvornikov has a history of targeting civilians. His appointment signifies an apparent streamlining of Russia's chain of command. Some military analysts say it's an indication that the war could be set to enter a brutal new phase. Intelligence officials have said that Putin expected the invasion in February to be a swift and easy win for the Kremlin, but that it was met with unrelenting resistance. Experts have said that bringing in Dvornikov, a man known for his cruelty to civilians, is an attempt to break the spirit of the Ukrainian people. Dvornikov has been accused of using tools of terrorism in Syria, including torture centers, systemic rape, and the use of nerve agents. Zelensky addressed the South Korean parliament on Monday. He said that tens of thousands of civilians had likely been killed in the besieged port city of Mariupol. Residents of Mariupol were left without electricity and running water and had little food for weeks as they lived under threat of missile strikes and shelling. Zelensky said, despite the destruction, Russia has continued its offensive. According to the United Nations, as of Friday, at least 1,700 civilians have been killed in Ukraine. Another 2,400 people have been injured. Experts have warned that the real numbers are likely far higher. A new report examines what clothing brands are doing to get rid of toxic chemicals known as PFAS. These chemicals are hazardous to human health and persist in the environment for a very long period of time. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
A new report grades clothing companies based on their commitment on phasing out a toxic class of chemicals known as PFAS. Three of the companies graded are based in Oregon, including Keen Footwear, which received an A- for removing PFAS from its shoes. However, Nike and Portland-based Columbia Sportswear fared worse, getting D-plus and F-grades, respectively. Charlie Fisher is state director of the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. He says PFAS is used to make clothing water, grease, and stain resistant.
The problem is that these chemicals are toxic to human health and persist in the environment in our bodies for so long that they have been given the nickname forever chemicals. And exposure to PFAS has been linked to really a wide range of serious health effects like kidney and liver disease, immune system suppression, and even cancer.
Of the 30 apparel brands surveyed in the report, 18 received a D grade or lower for their weak commitments to eliminating PFAS. Levi Strauss received the highest marks. The report was compiled by the Natural Resources Defense Council, Fashion Forward, and the U.S. PIRG Education Fund. Fisher says companies such as Columbia Sportswear are making some efforts to get PFAS out of their supply chain. He says Columbia Sportswear has a sustainable clothing line committed to removing PFAS this year.
It demonstrates that they believe there's a feasibility in removing PFAS from the supply chain, yet they haven't made any commitments for the rest of their products. And so they show that it's possible, and we just think that it's time that they take the next step.
The report recommends companies phase out PFAS and replace them with safe alternatives. It also says that apparel brands should label clothing that has PFAS in it so that consumers make informed decisions about what they're buying. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
President Joe Biden is nominating a former U.S. attorney to run the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. The move is part of the administration's plan to deal with so-called ghost guns, privately made firearms that do not have serial numbers. Steve Dettelbach served as a U.S. attorney for Ohio from 2009 to 2016. His confirmation will likely be difficult as President Biden had to withdraw the nomination of his first candidate following opposition from Republicans and some Democrats. The ATF director's position was made confirmable in 2006. Since then, only one nominee, former U.S. attorney B. Todd Jones, has been successfully confirmed. The administration also plans to release the finalized version of its ghost gun rule. Justice Department statistics show that 24,000 ghost guns were recovered by law enforcement at crime scenes and reported to the government between 2016 and 2020. In addition, ghost guns have been increasingly encountered when federal agents seize guns in undercover operations from gang members and other criminals. The critical component in building an untraceable gun is what's known as the lower receiver. An unfinished receiver can be legally bought online with no serial numbers and without the need for a license. The new rule changes the definition of a firearm under federal law to include unfinished parts, like the frame of a handgun or the receiver of a long gun. It requires those parts to be licensed and to include serial numbers. Manufacturers must also run background checks before a sale, as they do with other commercially made firearms. The requirement applies regardless of how the firearm was made, meaning it includes ghost guns made from individual parts, kits, or by 3D printers. The ghost gun rule has been circulating for nearly a year. Gun safety groups and some Democrats in Congress have recently been pushing hard for the Justice Department to finalize it. The new rule will likely be met with resistance from gun rights advocacy groups. Gun Owners of America said the rule violates the U.S. Constitution and several federal laws and vowed to fight it. However, gun safety advocacy groups like Every Town for Gun Safety applauded Biden's move and believe both Dettelbach's appointment and the finalized rule will help combat gun violence. John Feinblatt, president of Every Town for Gun Safety, added, quote, "Ghost guns look like a gun. They shoot like a gun and they kill like a gun. But up until now, they haven't been regulated like a gun." You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on how ending mask mandates puts immunocompromised people at risk with David Rosenberg, followed by Noise Filter. Then at 6, it's Labor Radio, and at 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 35 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with possible snow showers and a high of 44. Today in history, in 1814, Napoleon Bonaparte, Emperor of France and one of the greatest military leaders in history, abdicates the throne and is banished to the Mediterranean island of Elba. Less than 1 year later, he escaped his island exile and returned to Paris, where he reclaimed his emperor title in a period known as the Hundred Days. However, he was then defeated at the Bloody Battle of Waterloo. Napoleon's defeat signaled the end of France's domination of Europe. He abdicated for a second time and was exiled to the remote island of St. Helena in the southern Atlantic Ocean, where he lived out the rest of his days. The quote of the day is from French military and political leader Napoleon Bonaparte, who said, quote, "A revolution can be neither made nor stopped. The only thing that can be done is for one of several of its children to give it a direction by dint of victories." It's Alcohol Awareness Month, and one of the biggest concerns this year is that the pandemic has led people to drink more. Alcohol use disorder, or alcohol addiction, can lead to serious health consequences. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
April is Alcohol Awareness Month, highlighting some of the serious consequences from drinking too much. Excessive alcohol use contributes to more than 95,000 deaths each year, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Scott Itano, a family medicine physician in Seattle, says the pandemic has exacerbated dangerous drinking habits.
People used to have normal coping mechanisms such as travel, sports, seeing their friends. And when they were locked into their houses in quarantine, they really had fewer outlets, and some of them turned to alcohol. And then that alcohol use spiraled, I saw in some of my patients, and turned into alcohol use disorder.
Alcohol use disorder is the medical term for alcohol addiction, which is considered a disease. Itano says it's possible to have a healthy relationship with alcohol, but as with other things, the problem is using it in excess. He says the general rule is that men should limit themselves to 2 drinks a day and women 1 a day. Itano says alcohol use disorder has serious health consequences, including an increased risk of multiple types of cancer. He says drinking sometimes is seen as a method of self-treatment for underlying mental health concerns, such as depression or anxiety.
If you ever feel like you're starting to go down that path where you're drinking more alcohol than you typically do, or you're feeling more stressed or anxious or depressed and drinking at the same time, reach out early. That's our job here as primary care clinicians, and we're comfortable dealing with this and want to help.
Given how common this disease is, Itano says most people know someone who has struggled with it or still is struggling. He advises speaking directly to the person if you feel there is an issue.
I think the important thing is just calling it out and having a face-to-face conversation, conveying your level of concern and that you care about them and just what you've noticed and witnessed, and then seeing what they say from there.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers says the U.S. may be headed for a recession. Vladimir Putin appoints a new Ukraine war commander, and Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney says the January 6th committee has enough evidence to bring criminal charges against former President Donald Trump. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Historically, when we've had inflation above 4%, and we've had unemployment below 4%, essentially always since World War II, that's been followed by a recession within the next 2 years.
Former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers on the risk that Fed interest rate hikes could bring a recession if inflation doesn't slow. A new CNBC poll finds consumers cutting spending in response to rising prices, and even higher income households are showing some signs of financial stress. Summers called Russia's invasion of Ukraine, adding to surging oil prices and supply chain issues, a quote, perfect storm. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says U.S. intelligence shows Kremlin war plans include intentionally targeting civilians in Ukraine. Russia tapped a new commander to take over the so far failing invasion, a general who ran scorched earth attacks in Syria. Principal researcher at RAND Corporation, retired Army Colonel David Johnson.
And I think the pressure on Putin and on the Russian military now to perform well, to take Donetsk in Luhansk and consolidate that area is enormous at this point. So I think he's going to do whatever it takes to be successful.
The government of Ukraine says it is bracing for a massive fight in the east. It is encouraging civilians to leave the area in spite of strikes that have hit refugees. White House Chief Medical Advisor Anthony Fauci said coronavirus cases are down nationwide, but the U.S. could follow the U.K. and see a surge driven by the BA.2 subvariant.
When you have a highly transmissible virus like the BA.2 and you have pulling back on mitigation methods, at the same time there's waning immunity, we're going to see an uptick.
Fauci said by fall, folks may need a second booster and eventually yearly vaccinations like a flu shot. Former President Donald Trump has endorsed Dr. Mehmet Oz in the Republican Pennsylvania Senate primary. Oz has been accused of promoting weight loss scams and quack medicine. Later, the former president joined three other House and Senate candidates at a rally in Selma, North Carolina. There, Trump again attacked President Joe Biden and falsely called the 2020 election stolen.
From the Afghanistan disaster to the Ukraine disaster, everything we're seeing is a consequence of this horrible, horrible election. It was rigged, it was stolen, it was a disgrace.
Sunday, Republican Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney said the House January 6th committee now has enough evidence to refer the former president for criminal charges. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Alaska State Senate recently passed its version of a bill that would clear the way for the state and tribes to begin work on education compacting, and students took part in the University of Kansas First Nation Students Association's Powwow and Indigenous Cultures Festival. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Alaska State Senate recently passed its version of a bill that would clear the way for the state and tribes to begin work on education compacting. The legislation will now head to the House. Several tribes and Alaska's largest Native organization are backing the bill. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports.
The bill, SB 34, was originally written to allow the State Department of Education and Early Development to allow a series of tribal compacted pilot project schools. Under this version, the schools would have opened as soon as the fall of 2023. The Senate Education Committee substituted it with another bill that gives the Education Department and tribes more time to flesh out what the 5 pilot projects will look like. Then, the Department of Education will present its final plans to the next legislature. Education Department Tribal Liaison Joel Isaac says this extra time is critical for the tribes to plan the schools they want.
The immediate effect is the time to scope, the time to come up with a plan, and it brings tribes directly into that process.
The 5 pilot project schools could open as soon as fall 2025. In tribal education compacting, tribes can tailor their students' education to their own needs, which they hope could rectify the low rates of graduation and attendance in Alaska Natives. Tribal education compacting in Alaska is based on the success of tribal compacted schools in Washington State. The Senate passed SB 34 with only one nay vote, from Eagle River Senator Laura Reinbold.
We need to know exactly what the tribe is and what they stand for, who's allowed to be in, etc.
Reinbold said she opposed it on the grounds that she doesn't understand how tribes get their members. The Senate bill will now head to the State House, where it will meet up with its House counterpart. Both the Alaska Federation of Natives and the Department of Education support the Senate's version of the bill. For National Native News, I'm Olivia Eberts.
For the first time in 2 years, students, staff, and the public took part in the University of Kansas First Nation Student Association's Powwow and Indigenous Cultures Festival. It was held Saturday in Lawrence. People were eager to celebrate after the annual event was put on hold due to the pandemic. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
Hundreds of people came to experience the KU First Nation Student Association or FENSA Powwow and Festival. It had many activities beyond the powwow, including lectures, storytelling, and cultural demonstrations. Lori Hasselman, Native American Student Success Coordinator, says they are hearing great comments.
I think we're really excited and really pleased with how everything has gone so far.
One of the panels included Kansas Congresswoman Sharice Davids-Hochunk talking about her children's book, Charisse's Big Voice, and how she wanted all people to feel included in her writing as not only one of the first Native American women elected to Congress, but the first openly LGBTQ congressperson to represent Kansas in Washington.
There are so many different ways to exist, and they're all okay. And there's not one right way to do life.
One special guest included director of KU basketball operations, Fred Quartelbaum, who brought the 2022 Men's NCAA National Basketball Trophy to the powwow, which thrilled many fans. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
Sea Alaska Heritage Institute is hosting a lecture this week on Native identity and blood quantum. The talk will examine how Native people are identified, biological, cultural, and legal, and the ways blood quantum determines membership in tribes and governmental benefits. The Tuesday afternoon lecture will be streamed online by Sea Alaska. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A climate activist journeyed down the Missouri River. Graham Jordison kayaked through seven states and past 10 coal plants. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Graham Jordison of Lincoln, Nebraska, works as an organizer with Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, helping communities push for the closure of local coal power plants. But last summer, he set out to explore some of those communities from a different vantage point, the seat of his kayak. Over 74 days, he paddled the length of the Missouri River. That's more than 2,000 miles, through seven states, and past 10 coal plants with tall, looming smokestacks.
It's eye-opening when you do see them and they're out in the middle of nowhere.
Along the way, he met with other activists to share his experiences and learn about their work. And the trip also gave him a chance to connect with local residents at restaurants, bars, and along the riverbank.
People come up to you and they ask you what you're doing out there and why you're doing it.
He says some people are fossil fuel workers and worry about how plant closures will affect their communities. So he valued the chance to talk with them, not as an activist, but as a fellow human being with shared concerns about people's lives.
It's just a reminder of how similar we all are, and I just have to take that to heart and continue to organize through that lens.
As he works for a clean energy future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 11th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and David Rosenberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramagon, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Times Like Now with Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews Rebecca Morris about the exhibit Barbara Kruger, Thinking of You, I Mean Me, I Mean You. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth look at how ending mask mandates puts immunocompromised people at risk. We'll be right back.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Disability rights advocates are not happy with the Centers for Disease Control's new guidelines that allow a large percentage of Americans to stop the practice of social distancing and wearing masks indoors. The CDC's guidelines allow counties to independently consider hospitalization and case data rather than the number of cases alone in calculating the risk of the coronavirus. Beatrice Adler-Bolton is a blind, low-vision, and chronically ill disability justice advocate and co-host of the Death Panel podcast. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. He asked her what she thought of the CDC's decision.
I'm not of the personal mindset that we're anywhere near ready to be getting rid of mask mandates, particularly in public places like workplaces, schools, retail locations. And that's informed by the fact that I'm immunocompromised, so I'm high risk. So I'm acutely aware of essentially what removing mask mandates does to people like me, people who are medically vulnerable, who don't have the same response to the vaccine as everyone else. Removing mask mandates makes things a lot more dangerous for us, and it makes us a lot less welcome in day-to-day society. It sort of keeps us out of public life.
And so you have a kind of patchwork across the country, you know, from state to state, even from city to city and business to business, really. So how do you deal with that?
Well, it presents a challenge, particularly for people like me in the workforce who may not have so much control over whether or not they can mask at work. Because as you said, there is a patchwork. It really depends on sort of where you live, where you're working, what